Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise? The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Now, later on, we'll talk to the always very thoughtful, erudite Simon Cooper about the Mbappe coronation last night at the Nou Camp. I'll update you on the Champions League this evening. Second half's just about to start. Porto have dominated Juventus. They're only a goal up. It's 1-0. With the second half about to start, they have pressed the holy bejesus out of Juventus all evening, and Juve are giving up chances in their own half. And then if last night was about Mbappe, this evening is about Haaland. He has scored twice for Borussia Dortmund. Really good quality goals from Haaland, and they are 3-1 up away to Sevilla. Meanwhile, in the Premier League, Everton 1, Manchester City 1 is the latest. It's just gone half-time there. City took the lead through Phil Foden, and then Richarlison equalised on 37 minutes, so it's 1-1 in that game. Earlier on this evening, it finished 1-1 between Burnley and Fulham. Now, I'm very happy to introduce a name lots of you will know, former Celtic player, 300-plus games for Manchester United across 11 seasons. He left in 1984. Scottish international, of course. Managed Stoke in the 90s, still lives there now. Lou Macari, great to have you with us this evening.
Thanks, Joe.
How's the form? You're well?
It's fine. Everything's fine.
Good. Well, listen, you know I want to talk to you because by any standards you've done an extraordinary thing. You might take us back 4 years ago maybe to the genesis of this whole thing. You were sitting down for a cup of tea and reading the local paper.
I was. And in the local paper, there's a big debate about the number of homeless people in Stoke-on-Trent. Some councillors were saying there was very few, single figures. Other councillors were saying there's over 100, so I thought, I'll go and see for myself. Took a trip up into Hanley, parked my car, walked across the road, found 12 homeless people in one doorway, and I went and found another six in another doorway. So I quickly had the opinion there was too many. That was in one road. Went round the corner, I found another half a dozen or so, and went home. I was satisfied there was more than the original single figures number that some councillors were talking about, and just sat back and thought, is there anything I could do to help those people that are on the streets? And fortunately, Joe, due to my previous career of Celtic and Manchester United and playing for Scotland, I called upon a few friends who had dealt with over the years and in management as well, that were on the council, and asked them to find me a building. And if they found me a building, I'd open the door, I'd bring in the homeless people, and I would feed them, clothe them, and put a roof over their head. And that simply was it, Joe. I didn't intend to do anything else. I had no idea what it was like to be homeless. I had no idea what it was like for them to be continually on the streets. I just knew it wasn't pleasant. So I quickly achieved that because I did believe I could achieve it. And 4 years later, I'm still there because it's gone so well for us in terms of looking after people and in terms especially of the support that I've had from everyone, not just in this area, but we've had recognition from FIFA. Now, I didn't have any recognition during my football career at any time from FIFA, but we've had it as a homeless shelter here. As you know, FIFA's in Switzerland. We're in Stoke-on-Trent. And to have that recognition, that tells me we've done something right, or we've done something that most people like, which is to help less fortunate people.
Lou, 4 years ago, when most people are reading that article in the local paper and they're seeing councillors disagree, and they'll think to themselves, that's interesting. I wonder what the issue is. I'll keep an eye out. And then they turn the page and see what's in the sports section. What prompted you to get in your car, do you think, that day?
Because I knew it wouldn't have been right to turn the page without trying to do something about it. And I thought, Joe, I've not done a great deal in my life to help other people because everything's been for me. I've had great football clubs. I'd been to Dublin plenty of times as well to work for yourselves and other people. And I'd been to the I think it's Capuchin Day Centre it was called.
Yeah.
I think it will still be there. And of course, that was a brother Kevin was in charge at the time. I don't know if he's still there. And I used to see people queuing round the street to come in for the lunch. And I used to go in with them and sit there with brother Kevin and thought, bloody hell, I've never known this was going on in the world. People begging for food, desperate for food. So it all really started for me in Dublin because I didn't see a lot of homeless people over my football career in Stoke and Trent where I live. But after the football career had gone, going into management and doing television especially, I'd been to Dublin. As I say, I'd stayed in a nice hotel in the main street in Dublin, and just round the corner was, I think it was Bow Street, B-O-W Street, Bow Street, where this Capuchin Day Centre was. And I used to see what was happening there. And that was the first indication I had to the less fortunate people, not just in Stoke-on-Trent, but in the world. So given an opportunity, which I knew I could do, and I knew I could feed people, Joe, and I knew I could get clothes for them, and I knew I could put the roof over their head, I simply decided, well, I'm going to do it. And 4 years ago, I set off to achieve that. We did achieve it, and 4 years later...
Still going.
We're still going.
Yeah. Brother Kevin is still there, by the way. He welcomed the Pope to the centre a couple of years ago as well. He's in his 80s now, right. So still going strong. When you get going and you open this centre, and I know with COVID now, the glamping pods have really caught the imagination and the media has been highlighting the glamping pods. But when you first open the centre and there's no COVID and people can interact and mix, how many people, Lou, were using the service? Could you meet demand? Did you have to turn people away? How did all that work in those initial years?
In the initial years, we had a small building. It was too crowded. It was too cramped. There was no flexibility in terms of watching TV or listening to radio. There was one channel on because whoever had the remote control was in complete control of the centre, really. So that was a problem. It was a problem on a Saturday, especially when football was on, and it was on various channels and different teams were on different channels. And we had a mixture of Stoke, Man United, Celtic, Port Vale. We had a mixture of those supporters, City, Liverpool. And so there was always a bit of a tussle on a match day, Saturday especially, to get hold of that remote control. When we went into the pods, I just decided I'd ring the Football League Managers Association, of which I'm a member, and ask Richard Bevan, who's in charge, could he get me some TVs, because I knew they had a sponsor, LG, and I wanted 46 televisions for 46 pods. And a week later, the 46 televisions arrived. We put them in the pods along with heating. They had the number on each pod. So for the first time in their life, probably, the people that stayed with us had some sort of identity, and they had a number, they had an address. And the biggest thing of all, though, was the televisions, because the first day we actually opened in the new centre, they all had their tellies, and I came in and I thought, everybody's left me. Everybody's gone. You could hear a pin drop. And the big difference was they were now in their own pods, watching their own television, probably tuned into at the time, believe it or not, Brexit and things like that, which they would have no interest in, but it was on the telly. Then the virus came along, and the televisions again helped educate them to what the virus was all about, because they were saying to me, well, we haven't got the virus. We can go out. There's no reason for us to stay in. And I was having a bit of a job, Joe, of convincing them that everyone's got to be locked down, and that includes yourself. And the televisions have been a bit of a miracle. I wouldn't say an actual miracle, but they've helped enormously to change, or help to change, the lifestyle, of which I'm not in control of that. I'm not a great believer in I will actually change their lifestyle, but I did believe, Joe, that I could feed them, a bit like the day centre in Dublin. I could feed them, I could clothe them, and I could look after them and put a roof over their head. With the generosity of the people in Stoke-on-Trent and surrounding areas, and people all over the world. I'm getting calls from everywhere, and people want to help. People want to donate things to me. They want to donate money. We had a guy come in at Christmas and wrote me out a cheque for £5,000. Wow. I'd never seen him before. I'll never see him again, probably. Mm. And that's been the support that we've had. And that's through the help of, certainly through the help of football.
I think as well, people are responding to just what's so very clearly goodness on your part. It's just no agenda. What age were you? 4 years ago, as a 67-year-old man just wanting to do something good, and yeah, and people want to help you. It's very interesting what you say about the TVs, and maybe clearly someone on the streets isn't going to have a TV or a way to plug into society maybe, and how that's almost impacted on their lifestyle in a way. But also that point you make about having a number over the door, you know, and an address if they want to even think about getting a job, or their own private space. Like, you know, even in other shelters, who, and they're all doing brilliant work, but I don't know, I'm sure I'm like a lot of people, the thought of your own private space where you can make it tidy and make it hospitable and make it yours must psychologically just mean so much to some people.
I agree with you, though, Jordan. The job centre, that was always a big thing. They used to go to the job centre, had no address, obviously, they were on the streets. So getting an address for them, which they had in our previous place, was good. But having their own number to, I think, proudly say to the people in the job centre, and Universal Credits, they've got to register with them. I think to say to them, I stay at number 5 or number 10 or number 7, Regent Road in Hanley, Stoke-on-Trent. Mm. I think that's a big deal as well, Joe. And I wouldn't have, before I got involved with homeless people, I would never have considered that as any big deal, because I've been fortunate. I've been fortunate in football to have played for Celtic and Manchester United. And I don't think there's many people in the world can better that. Mm. I've been fortunate. I was at Celtic for 6 years. I come in and I took the place of some of the Lisbon Lions. So I realised that was an achievement in itself. And then I went to Manchester United and Beslaw, Charlton, and played with those three before they left, and played with a Manchester United team that got better. You know, and people keep thinking getting better as a team can happen overnight. I experienced it didn't happen overnight, but when it did happen, Manchester United was a better team. People still talk about the team I played for. So I look back and think how fortunate I've been. And now I'm dealing with people that are the very opposite. I realise the huge gap between being fortunate and being not so fortunate. I won't say unfortunate, because sometimes homeless people don't react the way they should do and get criticised for it. And I wouldn't say that criticism is wrong, because some of them, due to the drugs and due to the drink, get it wrong in the town centres and do things wrong, and people have not so good opinions of them. But I just like to think most people would understand that when they've got drugs inside them, when they've had too much alcohol, that's not the real person. And I'm fortunate in here, Joe, I see the real person, and I see the wrong person probably in the space of a week. And it's quite scary.
I'm sure it is. And on that front, you know, it's such a scourge in society, drink and drugs. And, you know, I'm sure for people who fall on hard times, it's just a relief. It's an escapism, and it's, you know, highlight of their day, understandably. And we'd probably all be the same. How do you manage residents, I guess, of your centre in the throes of drink and drug addiction, if they turn up in a bad state, or if, you know, they want to bring something onto the property? They're tricky issues for you to try and know what the right thing to do is.
Very tricky issues. We've got a number of people in here at the moment that rely on alcohol, and saying that to me Joe, someone who started at Celtic with the strictest manager I've ever had in football, and the best man, and probably the best manager, Jock Stein. No drink was allowed. I know Celtic players in later years, people did talk about them drinking, but when Jock was in charge in the days of the Lisbon Lions, drink was taboo. He'd throw you out of the football club. I remember those days as an apprentice. I've seen people getting thrown out. It's different in here. I've got to understand, which, being a non-drinker all my life, still don't drink, it's a bit difficult for me to understand, but I've got to understand that, because it's part of being somebody on the streets who's an alcoholic. It's part of that that doesn't go away overnight. It won't go away overnight. I would love it to go away. I'd love to change it. I'd love to be able to get the better of the drugs, and I'd love to know the formula to get the better of all the drugs that are about at this moment in time. Mm. But I realise I'd be wasting my time concentrating on that, right, the drinking and drugs. I'm concentrating on Joe, making sure there'll be plenty of food. We give them plenty of food. Four meals a day they get, breakfast, lunch, evening meal, and a supper. Nobody goes out from us slimmer than they come in here. I realise that's a good thing. No one's ever going to go hungry. And challenge of all, would be to beat the drugs and the drink.
Look, I'm sure. I don't know how you do that. There's no easy solution. And so, Lou, would there people staying with you for weeks, months on end, who effectively live there and they can hang around all day? They don't have to head out if they don't want to, kind of thing. Yeah.
That's it. Months, weeks, years. Got people with us that have been with us since the very start.
Wow.
4 years ago. Wow. They're still here. I don't think they're still here because I failed. I didn't set out to cure them of their addictions, because better people than me have tried it and they've failed. And what they are, they are. All I can do is give them a bit of advice. I've taken some to Old Trafford. Now, I don't know who you support, Joe, but some people will say that's a punishment. Other people will say it's a good thing. I didn't believe in it was something they may never, ever achieve in their lifetime.
You must then have taken people to their first ever experience of Old Trafford. That must be an amazing gift to give to somebody.
Well, that's why I did it, Joe. I realised that, because I know what it's like having played for United and still working there, I know what it's like for people to come on the trips, the day trips from Dublin and all of the other parts of the Republic of Ireland. It's a big deal to them, and they've been time and time again. But when they get to Old Trafford, you can tell that it's another great day for them. So I realise if someone gets there for the first time, it's going to be an unbelievable day for them, no matter who they support. No matter who they support. And just before Christmas, a week before Christmas, we had a chef down from Manchester United, along with some other staff members at the club, who put on, the week before Christmas, put on Christmas lunch for them. The chef was there cooking, and this is the chef that cooks for Manchester United and all the people that support the club financially in terms of sponsors. So it was a big day for us, and it was great. That was another little achievement for us.
And so, Lou, I think we've all been out on nights in the winter where it's just bitterly cold and you're running to your car. And it has crossed my mind, because we have a terrible problem in Dublin with homelessness. Like, it's a disgrace, you know, it's shame on all of us, really. And it crosses my mind when you see them, because, you know, plenty around where we work or whatever. How do they get through the night? Like, I couldn't imagine being out for an hour, let alone, you know, 12 hours and then into the following day. What do the people in your centre tell you about life on the streets? How do they survive it? I can't even imagine. I wouldn't be able for it.
I'm glad you mentioned it, Joe, because I did it for one night at Stoke Football Club, because Stoke thankfully put on a one night in a year for us to invite people to sleep rough, to see what it's like. And the proceeds of that go to our centre. So Stoke have been brilliant with that. But I intended to go every year, but I did it for the first time. It took me about 5 days to recover. And even then I didn't recover. And I promised myself I'd never do it again. So it made me more aware of how homeless people, how they manage to do it, I don't know. Because they do it for days, months, and then years. So there's a certain toughness about them, which I have experienced in here. And I do say to them from time to time, don't step out of line. I don't want to show you the door. But I don't think that's a massive problem for them when they've done it before. I know they still prefer to be in a pod with the radiator and the heat in there and the television and everything else that goes with it. But I don't think it scares them that much, the way it would scare yourself, myself, and the rest of the public that we know of. I don't think it scares them as much as that. They've been battle-hardened to that sort of lifestyle. I know they'd prefer the lifestyle they've got at this moment in time.
And so I suppose when you're chatting to them, you might eventually get a feel as to how they ended up on the streets or how they ended up homeless. Is there a common theme across the many that you've met over the years? Is there, coming from tough homes, or maybe it's addiction or just bad luck? Is there a theme which tends to crop up more often than not?
I think there's everything, Joe. Everything you just mentioned there, I could repeat. So there's no certain way of doing it. But what I do realise already, and I don't like the thought of it, that fortunately, if we quickly get rid of the virus we've got, our next biggest job is to get rid of these drugs. Mm. It's terrible.
Yeah, really.
It is. And it's going to be a massive job, because in the 4 years I've been doing it, I've seen a gradual increase. I don't want to see an increase. I've seen the reaction from people when they're on them. I've seen people that I know that are good people up on rooftops, throwing slates off of rooftops, doing other silly things, doing lots of silly things and doing things they wouldn't do if they didn't have drugs in them, especially the drugs when they do these crazy things.
Yeah. Have there been great stories to come out of this over the 4 years? Have people got back in their feet? Have they managed to get jobs? Have they managed to move on? Have there been moments like that where this has been incredibly fulfilling for you?
Yeah, because that gives me as, probably now I'm doing this, it gives me as much satisfaction as a win on a Saturday when I played at Celtic and Man United. Because it's just as difficult, no, it's even more difficult to get that you've just mentioned over a period of time, because it doesn't happen that often. And sometimes, and I have been surprised, it's happened with the least likely people that have stayed with me.
Right.
If you'd have said to me, like a certain couple that did get married, if you'd have said to me that when they were in here, it would happen for those two, I'd have said, no, they're too much into the drugs. They're too much into shoplifting. They're too much into stealing. It's not going to happen for them. And it has happened. And I thought, well, it'll only be for so long. But I think the fact that a child came along quickly was a big help. And that couple are still together. And I can't believe it sometimes that knowing all I did know about the couple, that all that I've just told you that's happened has happened.
And are they away from the centre now?
They're away from the centre. Oh, they went from the centre a year ago. I didn't think it would last. And I said, the child came along. So they have lasted. The child has lasted. And really, I take the view, I might be wrong, Joe, but I take the view that the child has been a bit like the televisions in the pods, that's been a big, big difference to us here. I think the child in this relationship has probably been the deciding factor that they would cut down on the drugs and try and make someone's life, which is this child, a lot better for them.
Are you at the centre now?
I am, yes.
Is this your, are you there every day? Is this your full-time job almost?
If the lockdown hadn't come, then I'd be at Old Trafford. I'd be there doing the hospitality. I'd be there doing the television most weeks, which was a great release for me. From the centre, and the sooner we get back to normal routine, I'll be back to Old Trafford 2 days a week probably.
Yeah.
But at this moment in time, it's a crazy thing to say, but I spend my spare time here, and it keeps me reasonably sane. Because if I was locked up in home all the time, I'd probably be going crackers, Joe.
It's an extraordinary thing you've done, though. Like, at 71, you should have the feet up. You should be scared stiff of this virus. You should be, taking it easy. And here you are at 9:30 at night and you're at the centre. What effect do you think all of this has had on you as a person?
If I'd failed, I'd be in distress. But when we, this week, we've had all the big newspapers in England, they've all been down here. As I say, in the past, probably about 3 months ago, we had FIFA. I've had a continual stream of TV companies. I've got them coming tomorrow, ITV and one or two others. So that tells me, nothing else tells me, it's been a good thing for me to do. Because that recognition of all the people I've just mentioned, it's a great recognition for people to be even following you. I'm happy I did it.
Yeah,
I'll never regret it. I could have regretted it if it hadn't gone so well for us. But I tried to decide to be fair with the people we had, a little bit lenient in the early days. I was getting accused by staff of being lenient, too lenient.
Too soft.
Too soft. I was never too soft. No, I wasn't, Joe, because I've got no fear of anybody in here. When I've got to stand up to them, I will stand up to them.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think that sort of reflects my football days, where I had no fear of anybody. I would stand up to anybody. And that started with my days at Celtic, with a manager who instilled that in me, who advised me what to do, what not to do, who helped me get off on the right footing in football. And I'll certainly always be grateful to Jock Stein, not just Jock Stein, Sean Fallon, from the
Republic, man,
who was my reserve team manager. These two guys taught me great habits. And then I was fortunate moving on in football to have other people who taught me great habits as well. And Tommy Docherty, and Dave Sexton, and Ron Atkinson at Old Trafford. Three different types of guys, three different types of managers, but all people that that I learned a lot from.
Another night we must chat to you about your football career. But listen, it's just amazing. You're in the 0.001% of people who would be flicking through the paper and see a story like that and say, I'm going to hop in my car and see what it's like and then do something about it. And 4 years later, you're at the centre as a 71-year-old still doing this. I don't mean to be ageist at all, by the way, but just...
Oh, you keep repeating that, Joe.
I know, I'm sorry. Well, it's just... it's a time in your life where you'd put your feet up. And because you said...
71-year-olds after younger people.
Well, I know. Listen, and you'll be doing it for another 30, 40 years, I'm sure. But I think you said an interesting thing, which was that you felt maybe I haven't done much in my life for other people. And I think a lot of people feel like that. I think we would all like to do more and then life gets in the way, doesn't it? And you did it. And that's what really jumps out to me, you know?
Yeah, I did it because I thought I could do it. I knew I could do it. And I'd have felt ashamed of myself if I hadn't have attempted to do what I honestly and genuinely thought I could do. Supply the food, or help with the help of other people to supply the food, get clothes, which we did do, and get them a roof over their head, which we did do, and we've got 24 paid staff, we've got no volunteers. I thought we could get 24 paid staff to look after them. And everybody's got different views, and we have lots of arguments in here about the people we look after. But at the end of the day, I'm the boss, they've got to do what I tell them, and anybody they think shouldn't be in here, I will fight their corner and say, no, I'm sorry, I think they're good enough to stay with us. Whether they make progress right away or not doesn't matter to me. Over a period of time, I'm hoping for a bit of progress, but they're off the streets. And having experienced myself for one night, and only one night, and it will only ever be one night, I would never want to do that. I'd never want to do it again. And I realise that with all the problems they may have and with all the shortcomings they may have, that they're entitled to an opportunity. They get that opportunity, and I hope it. I've mentioned one thing in particular that did happen for us. There's been other things. I'm just hoping, moving ahead now, Joe, I can talk about in the coming years, I can talk about other things that... we can all be proud of.
Yeah, well, listen, Great to have you on. Well done. It's brilliant. Like, all of us doff our caps to you. It's just an amazing thing that you're doing for loads of people. So, Lou McCurry, pleasure. Wish you well with all the centre in its future. Hope it goes well. Keep up the great work, and we'll talk to you again sometime, I'm sure.
Brilliant. Thanks, Joe.
All right. Lou McCurry there. We'll let you know what's going on in the football before I go to an ad break. Sorry, I haven't been watching it, given the chat with Lou. It's 3-1 to Borussia Dortmund. 64 minutes in the clock. Haaland scored twice this evening, if you're just tuning in and missed that. And Porto have scored a second against Juve. They're bossing Juve, Porto, really, certainly from what I've seen thus far. So they're 2-0 up at home to Juventus. An hour on the clock at Goodison, 1-1 between Everton and Man City is the latest. And earlier on, it finished 1-1 between Burnley and Fulham. The football show is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. We have Simon Cooper with us next.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise? The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
Welcome back. Riyad Mahrez has scored Manchester City's second, so they are now 2-1 up away to Everton, and that will move them 10 points clear in the Premier League. Still Porto 2-0 up on Juve, and the Haaland-inspired Borussia Dortmund are 3-1 up away to Sevilla. Last night, of course, was about Kylian Mbappe, and if he does go on to be the world's best player, then last night at the Nou Camp will probably be remembered as a symbolic handing of the baton. Simon Cooper is with us. Evening, Simon.
Good evening. Hi.
Special players, I guess, do special things on big nights, and it elevates them. And of course, we are talking about a World Cup winner already. So, you know, he wasn't a nobody. But in the Mbappe catalogue, last night felt significant.
I mean, this is what happens when you get the world's fastest forward against the world's slowest defence, supposedly top-class defence. He must have been thinking, my God, I get to play against Piqué and Longley in central defence. What is the problem?
Yeah. The quality of his goals, that said, was very impressive, and they were different types of goals. For some reason, the first one with the quick feet and the explosiveness, I just thought of Brazilian Ronaldo in that moment for some reason. And then, of course, the cultured hat-trick goal into the far corner, a crowning moment. So is this guy rapid? See, I don't see much Ligue 1, I must confess. I know you're based in Paris. Is he doing this stuff regularly? Is he yeah. Coming in spurts, or where is he?
He's doing it very regularly. I mean, he has 110 goals for Paris in 3.5 seasons now. He is long recognised. From late teenage, he was recognised as the best striker in Ligue 1. He is just really waiting to show this on a larger stage. But the thing is that he had always thought he would go to Real Madrid or Barcelona, but neither of those clubs now looks better than PSG. So he's talking of staying at PSG another year. They don't want to sell him in the middle of a football recession. You know, they want to get the highest transfer fee in history for him. And then I think it's probably more likely he'll go to England and prove just how good he is. But in France, there's really very little doubt. This is not a flash in the pan. And I must admit, I was slightly surprised when you were presenting it like that, because just in my mind, of course, Mbappe does these things.
Mm. No, I mean, it's nothing new. And we're talking about what the first teenager since Pele in 58 to score in a World Cup final. And we've seen him do remarkable things. There's a degree of Messi was on the pitch and Mbappe was just so wonderful and the whole world was watching. And it just felt like a rubber stamping of his status, almost, lest it was needed. His personality, what's it like? I don't speak French. I don't have a feel for him as a person beyond the football field.
Everyone thinks he's a nice guy. I mean, he says...
you say that like he's not.
No, I think he is.
Okay.
He said, look, I don't have a life. I can't go outside because I'm immediately mobbed by people. When my children ask me later, you know, tell us what you did as a young man, he'll say, I just sat at home. So that's a bit sad, but he's very articulate, intelligent, thoughtful. You know, he knows how good he is, but he's not big-headed, if that makes sense. Mm. He's a normal person who knows that he's an exceptionally good footballer. He was sort of raised to this. I mean, it was always expected that he would be a great footballer. His father was the coach of his local club, was a good footballer himself, a Cameroonian immigrant. Mother, Algerian immigrant, was a good handball player. So he grew up in a very sporty family. Older adopted brother, who's a French journeyman professional, I think out in Turkey. They were very unfazed by fame and success. You know, he went to Monaco at 16 because they figured, well, that's the quickest way into the first team of a good team. They've managed it in a very level-headed kind of way. I was also impressed that he has made a lot of remarks on social media about police violence. He's obviously following that very closely in the Black Lives Matter movement. I think all-round good egg would be the summary.
Right. And winning the World Cup at 19, maybe because he's been so unfazed by success all the way through, didn't derail him.
I was very struck by something he said in an interview that evening. You know, somebody said to him, oh, it's amazing, you're 18 years old and you've won the World Cup. Or was he 19? 19, he'd won the World Cup. And he said, yeah, this is already good, but now I need to do more.
Right.
And that struck me as a slightly sort of underwhelmed response to winning the World Cup and scoring a goal in the final as a 19-year-old. He'd sort of expected it. I mean, his teammates used to tease him during the World Cup. He's only 15 and look what he's done already, because they got a bit sick of all the hype around him. But he lets himself be teased.
Mm. Does that fly on the wall documentary about the World Cup win? I know you've watched that. How does he come across in that?
He's a jolly, kind of funny sort of person who, you know, 3 weeks later, he's back at PSG and giving his all in preseason training. I'd like to say that there's a dark side, but none has yet been discovered. He seems to be a good teammate to have.
And his level of superstardom in France must be just incredible. Is he simply known as Killian? Is he on the talk show circuit? Is he just a prominent face most days in the media?
Yeah, he's not really a celeb in the way that Neymar is, for example. Neymar is very much a partier and is often in the kind of French gossip press. And Mbappe is not. He doesn't really have a visible life outside football.
Right.
You also don't see him on kind of football talk shows even. He'll give, you know, pleasant interviews after matches. But there doesn't seem a huge desire for kind of fame and recognition. I mean, I think rather he flees from it because it is so mad.
Mm. He's going to continue to get better and better, I presume. I mean, still only 22 and all the frightening athleticism. I mean, he makes fellow pros look slovenly at times, and he'll further harness that and become more cultured and more experienced. So the ceiling for Mbappe is extraordinary, isn't it?
I'm not sure, because there's a lot of very fast strikers who get injured, often hamstrings, because they have very kind of long, loose hamstrings. Mm. And then it turns out they peaked in their early 20s. Michael Owen is an example of that. Robbie Fowler, Patrick Kluivert. They really had their best years by 22, 23. Mm. And at one point yesterday, when Griezmann stepped on his ankle, I think, and Mbappe went down in a lot of pain, French TV commentators very anxious, you know, oh my gosh, there's something wrong, because you do feel that that kind of pace is a very precious and endangered asset. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo is an example of somebody who's kept that going for nearly two decades now, partly by encasing himself in this kind of sheath of muscles. And Mbappe is much more muscular, of course, than people like Owen and Fowler. But it must still be a risk. But that muscle does protect him in part.
Yes. No, it's a fair point. Meanwhile, what of Messi last night? I didn't get to see this game live because I'm presenting the show most nights. I know coming into it, he had scored 11 goals in 10 games. And, you know, Barcelona had been beaten once in 18. And there was a sense maybe they were mustering up some kind of form. How was Messi last night?
I mean, there were a couple of moments. There was a rapid back heel, an exchange of passes or two, which broke down because his teammates are no longer, you know, Xavi and Iniesta of yesteryear or Suarez and Neymar. So otherwise, he does nothing. And so one reason PSG were able to break very quickly to Mbappe is that Barcelona defend with 10 men at best. And so Messi lets his defender pass. So PSG will work the ball out to a defender near Messi, and he has all the time in the world to look up and see where is Kylian. So, you know, if you're carrying Messi when you don't have the ball and you're playing a big team who often does have the ball, and Messi no longer has that acceleration he used to have, so you see that he's becoming more of a midfielder. He wants to supply, he wants to give other people passes and then not defend. So I hate to say it, but he's not the player he was. And you have to doubt whether he's the best player in the world. I mean, I was looking at stats that suggest that either Neymar or Haaland is currently the best player in the world, the best attacking player. It's harder to measure with defensive players.
Mm. And I don't suspect, even if the owners would quite like him, I don't suspect Pochettino fancies a team that has to defend with 10 men.
I mean, you can see either Paris or Manchester City buying Messi or getting him free on a free transfer and saying to him, look, you know, you're the greatest player of all time, but you're 34 years old now. He will be this summer. And so you'll play 70, 80% of matches. And it might be that in a very big match where we need 11 defensive players, that you will not be playing for 90 minutes of that match. So you'll be a kind of golden super sub in some matches and then just, you know, brought out to trounce smaller teams in others.
Mm.
That would be the offer made to him. I can see Messi just getting fed up with this very poor team he's in. Because, I mean, look, it's exciting that Paris won 4-1, but Juventus beat them 3-0, Bayern beat them 8-2, Liverpool beat them 4-0, Roma beat them 3-0. Juventus, Paris, I mean, in the last 4.5 years, they've had about 6 defeats of 3-plus goals in the Champions League. So this is just yet one more.
Mm. I know you've been writing about Barcelona and Messi, and the book, I think, is coming out in August, which we'll talk to you about then, looking forward to that. But given the litany of those defeats, you know, each of them in their own right almost era-ending, you know, it's a litany of embarrassment at the moment. What's your sense of Barcelona over the coming 5 years, given the financial situation? Is this about to get very, very dark indeed?
I think it is, because clearly they need a new team. I mean, I can imagine Busquets and Piqué saying this summer, look, you know, thank you for the memories, I'm retiring. And Griezmann is going to be 30. Messi may very well leave, and if he stays, he'll just drain the club of money, which he's done for the last few years. There's no money left. They have debts of over €1 billion. Most of that is short-term stuff they have to repay in the next year or so. And the Spanish licensing rules are quite tough, so the Spanish league is not going to let them just spend money on the never-never. And you saw, you know, the last few months, they wanted to buy Memphis Depay, Eric Garcia for really quite small amounts of money. They couldn't even afford those players. So they're going to have to restaff from the Masia largely. The Masia, the academy, is not producing great players. I can see some very kind of dull years coming for Barcelona.
Mm. Is there any particular way in which they've messed this whole thing up financially?
They did, because, you know, they were the richest club in the world, the highest revenues, and they had all these homegrown players for decades, so they didn't have to spend much on transfers. So between 2014 and 2019, I mean, I document this in the book, they spent about €1 billion on transfers.
Yeah.
Players like Griezmann, Coutinho, Dembele, Arda Turan, and most of it was just wasted. So they blew €1 million in 5 years, more than any other club spent in that period, with very little return. They lost Neymar. That was the most consequential football transfer of the 2010s. You know, Neymar was the best player of his generation, and he kind of wasted it in the French league, but he is brilliant. So yeah, they had the money, they spent it wrongly. It's gone.
And it ain't coming back, I guess, is the problem. They've no great way to generate that revenue again, do they?
Well, I mean, all clubs have had a loss of revenue. And with Barcelona, it's been more pronounced because it's actually quite a tourism-dependent club. I mean, for many matches, about 30,000 tickets are bought by tourists.
Yeah.
Now, if you've been in the new Camp the last couple of years, the Camp Nou, I should say, you'll have heard all sorts of different languages being spoken around you. And a lot of that money, you know, goes to the club. Some of it goes to the members who sell the season tickets. They've got the museum, they've got the megastore. Barcelona's a tourist city, so people come and they spend money there. So that's been very costly, the pandemic, more so than for a club like, you know, Manchester United or Dortmund. And the other thing is that they pre-spent, you know, they bought players, they had a spending splurge over 5 years. There's not really anything left.
Mm. Yeah, I heard Graham Hunter the other day saying the museum alone generates €26 million a year, which is a very tidy amount for a museum. What about Koeman and all this then last night? What was his demeanour last night? How will he be reacting, do you suspect, behind the scenes to all this?
I mean, he said to Marca, look, they are better than we are, especially physically. And I think that's the rational thing to say. I mean, you can blame Koeman, but then are you going to blame Setien as well for the 8-2? Are you going to blame Valverde for the thrashing by Liverpool? I can't remember who was in charge for the Roma match. I think it was also Valverde. So are these three different managers, they all idiots who are to blame for these massive defeats. I don't think so. I think this is a problem of the team. And I don't like it when people talk about lack of motivation or they're not hungry anymore. They are hungry. They're just too old.
Yeah.
They just don't have it anymore.
Yeah. There's not much Koeman can do about that, really, is there?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm very impressed that, you know, as you say, I think they went 10 matches in a row without defeat before they lost in the Cup to Sevilla last week. So likely now they're out of the Cup and they're out of the Champions League. I mean, they actually have an outside shot at winning the title. Mm. They're, you know, 8 points behind Atletico, played a game more, but you never know. They're in second place with Real Madrid, more or less. I don't think they'll win that either. So, yeah, it's likely to be this will be a trophy-less season and a huge embarrassment, at the end of which you lose, you know, core players and you have no one to replace them with. And then, you know, who in the Barcelona team do other big clubs want to buy? Mm. I would say Frenkie de Jong, Ansu Fati, if he comes back, you know, in a good way from injury, and Mark Ter Stegen, Marc-André Ter Stegen. And I think a club like Bayern is going to be in for a couple of those players.
Yeah. Well, the title of your book couldn't really be better. The Barcelona Complex, Lionel Messi and the Making and Unmaking of the World's Greatest Soccer Club. It's available to pre-order, I see here, with a quick Google. So I'm sure that'll do very well. Perfectly timed. I mean, you've did right at the end of the era, in it swoops.
Right at the end of the year, you were saying?
Right at the end of the era.
Yes, I turned out to be very lucky with that because I got the rise and the fall. When I started in early 2019, before the 4-0 against Liverpool, they were still arguably the best team in the world.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm writing about a brilliant club that's still brilliant. And during the research, I very quickly discovered I was also writing about the decline. So that it came out as a very different book than what I had started off thinking.
Interesting. You got your ending. Listen, always great to have you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fake crowd noise. The Emirates never sounded so good. Gamble responsibly. Gamblingcare.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.